I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Frank White's skill on the ball field is well known, but his time as the Jackson County executive has been less lauded. Will his big league legacy be enough to secure him four more years as head of the county government? Today, we review the critical issues he's up against with just 1 week to go until Election Day. Then, whether you consider it a gatekeeper problem or one of structural exclusion, the fact is that art institutions, like most American realms, are led overwhelmingly by white people. We'll find out what this means for academics and artists of color looking to take a leading role in the field or just make a career. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Frank White is well known in these parts for his stellar play as second baseman for the Kansas City Royals in the 70s and 80s when they were a little bit better than what Kyle Palmer just said. It's fair to say that his tenure as Jackson County executive hasn't been quite as smooth. Battles with county legislators, funding fights, and the big one, an ongoing dispute over how to deal with the rundown, overcrowded, and dangerous county jail have marked his tenure. Frank White is on the ballot this year, and that makes it a good time to review his tenure and the challenges that the county faces. With us to talk about it, Mike Hendricks covers the county for the Kansas City Star. Mike, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Sam Zeff covers Jackson County for KCUR. Sam, good to have you.
Good morning, Steve.
We originally had Frank White scheduled today. He initially accepted our invitation to be on the show, then withdrew when KCUR would not agree to his request to not discuss what he termed as his personal business. We responded by saying that when it came to the investigation into his finances now being reviewed by the Missouri Attorney General's office, that due diligence on our part required that we ask questions regarding that investigation. At that point, Frank White informed us he would not join us today. We'll get to that situation in just a little bit, but first, Mike Hendricks, how stiff a challenge does Frank White face when it comes to his reelection this year?
Zero. Frank, if Frank White were not a beloved member of the Kansas City Royals, had not won 8 gold gloves, he would be in serious trouble. There would have been a serious contender in the Democratic primary. However, no one felt it was worth, no one of any stature anyway, felt it was worth trying to compete with him, and that's not to denigrate his challenger Matthew Merriman, but he's a novice and doesn't have a chance.
Who is Matthew Merriman, Sam?
Public defender. He's a lawyer. I met him the other night at the League of Women Voters forum for Jackson County executive candidates, a forum that Frank White also refused to participate in. And he had some good ideas. He's studied up on the issues, presented himself well. But just to add just a little bit of balance to what Mike said, I'm going to give Frank just a 99% chance of losing. I think maybe there might be a 1% chance. But Matthew Merriman, if he had some political experience and some chops, would present as a very good candidate. But Frank White is hard to beat.
We'll find out more about Matthew Merriman. He'll be on our show tomorrow. And Mike Hendricks, no Republicans are running in this race?
No. We have Green Party candidates running, which is, again, you know, in the primary and obviously in general, but Richard Tolbert is one of them, a perennial candidate.
Yeah.
It's a clerical error.
I'm getting the picture here. Sam, Frank White has been the county executive for 2.5 years. How would you describe his tenure as the successor to former county executive Mike Sanders?
You know, he's been in a rock'em sock'em fight with the legislature since he started. His staff is not held in good stead by the legislature. So whatever his talents or failings are as an administrator, it seems to me that politically he's had just a brutal 2.5 years
because,
as county executive. I think that he came in and wanted to actually administer. There are some who believe that Mike Sanders wasn't that interested in actually administering the county, and the legislature essentially took over that function. And I think Frank White wanted to actually come in and administer. How well he's done, his ideas, that may be questionable, but I think he came in there ready to work, and that may have been part of the reason that he's been butting heads with some of the members of the legislature.
Well, part of the reason he's been butting heads is Sanders was a schmoozer. Sanders knew how to work the legislature. I started covering the legislature in 2011, the summer, and it was just everything was pretty much cut and dried. There were 8-1 votes because there was one Republican, Bob Spence, who would often vote against something. But Sanders would have worked the legislature before the meetings. Frank gets his back up. He's not that kind of a guy. He doesn't like to glad hand with the folks and try and work deals, and that's worked against him because that goes against the whole culture of the Jackson County Legislature.
You know, Sam, Steph, I've actually gotten the sense, and I've covered a few meetings of the county legislature during the last couple of years, that Frank is almost a little uncomfortable in the job. At least that's a sense you can get from watching him work.
Yeah, Mike is exactly right. He's not, I don't think he's that comfortable in that legislative arena. I mean, certainly he's spent his career in the public eye, both not just as a baseball player, but as a broadcaster. He's been a part of the fabric of Kansas City for 40 years. So I don't think it's that he's uncomfortable being in public. I think that there is, I think he's uncomfortable in that legislative setting. He didn't have a lot of government experience briefly on the county legislature, so he doesn't have a lot of public service experience. And as Mike said, not particularly willing to glad hand, meet in back room, back slap. I mean, that's a very Jackson County politics way of doing business.
Yeah. We're talking about Jackson County government and County Executive Frank White with the Stars' Mike Hendricks and KCUR's Sam Zeff. You know, Mike, the ongoing crisis at the jail in downtown Kansas City has been, I think, you know, his biggest challenge here. The complaint is that Frank White, as the county executive, hasn't been in a very big rush to resolve this situation, and he's let it fester. Is that fair?
Yes, it's absolutely fair, and that's largely, I think that was the genesis of his disputes with the legislature. The legislature wants to, or legislators generally want to move forward on the jail. He has dragged his feet from day one. There were some instances in which he was seen to minimize the jail situation. There was a meeting about a year ago in June, I think it was. And he had legislator Crystal Williams was one of his biggest supporters. And at that meeting, the jail came up, and there was some discussion, I think, about the sexual assaults or some of the assault, other kind of violence going on there. And Frank's response was, well, that's just the way jails are. And that just, he lost Crystal at that point, I think, or began to.
Is there a push, how strong of a push to get a new jail here, Sam, and build a new one, spend a few million bucks?
Yeah, the legislature certainly wants it. There's a lot of people in the county who want it. Frank, I think at first, didn't seem to be in that category, although I think he's moved over to that. I think he's somewhat resolved himself to the notion that I think they need a new jail. I do want to say that while the jail task force did seem to be just a way of delaying the inevitable. And I've covered those task force meetings, and it doesn't seem a lot is getting done. The person that he picked to run the corrections department, Diana Turner, seems to be a professional, takes it seriously. She is a career corrections person and seems to be doing well. But it's still a place where the elevators don't work, where it's hard to keep staff, where they're underpaid. It's dangerous for both staff and inmates. And I think eventually everybody's going to have to come to the realization that you may not be able to fix that.
I was going to say, how bad is the county jail? What do we know about that? And will they let reporters like you into the jail, Mike?
And answer your last question, no. They refused repeatedly. It was hard at first just to kind of get a feel for it because we're talking about three or four different buildings that are all connected. There was the original tower that went up in like 82, 83, an eight-story, nine-story, whatever they want to say. I'm confused, actually, how many levels there really are. And then there was an annex built, and then there's a regional correctional facility, which is an old Art Deco building right next to it. Anyway, the key problem with the jail right now is, in addition to the fact that there's a deferred maintenance for years and years, bad plumbing issues and filth and just deterioration, the elevator's falling apart, is the whole design of the jail. This multi-story facility requires lots more people and
guards
and it, a modern facility would be single level with maybe the guards slightly above to monitor a lot of people at once. They could operate with fewer people. It would be much more secure. That's the way jails are built right now. The one to fit the same number of folks as we have in there right now would be upwards of $200 million, perhaps up to three, depending on how many beds are allotted.
Would they rebuild it in downtown Kansas City?
No. And this is one bone of contention, is that it would probably have to go out to some, as they say, greenfield site or whatever, perhaps out near the city, but not close. And so there'd be some difficulty in getting prisoners to and from court. A lot of that could be taken care of with video conferencing. But also the other issue is bus service for people to visit, loved ones to visit people in the jail.
Sam, Frank White's Democratic opponent, we've mentioned his name here, Matthew Merriman, just wrote this in an op-ed piece in The Star. I'm quoting here, "The current county executive last November opted to form another committee to study the failed jail yet again." I think you referred to it here this morning. "It was to provide a report in 6 months, but 8 months later, there's still no report." Why not?
Well, 6 months, 8 months, 10 months. I don't think that a report from that jail task force is going to move the ball forward. I think that I've seen at these task force meetings them spin their wheels, talk about the history of that jail, talk about corrections in general, right? About things that I think are accepted in the trade right now about jails. And they've talked about all that. They've talked about previous reports done by consultants. So whether they took a year, 2 years, I don't think that that's going to add to the base of knowledge that we have about the Jackson County Jail.
So what's going to happen here? I mean, do the results of this year's elections in Jackson County, will that impact whether we get a new jail or not? Or is Frank White so sort of stuck here that we're not going to see forward progress toward a jail? Or how do you see it playing out?
Well, I think it's inevitable that there's going to be a jail.
Well, sooner or later, but is it going to happen next year or 5 years down the road?
Well, I would think it was going to take 5 years probably to actually get it done. But I think the initial steps will be taken either late this year or early next year.
Okay, so something like that, and we should get a new jail. Okay. What's the most recent thing Frank White has said about this jail here, Sam? Do you have the most recent sense?
Frank hasn't, at least around me, hasn't talked much about it. He's put his corrections director, who we talked about earlier, Diana Turner, out. She seems to appear before the legislature and talk. She's been perfectly willing to talk to reporters. She acknowledges problems, although she does toe the line. I mean, I think that she is a Frank White supporter. This is a job that she's been looking forward to, but I don't think anybody denies their problems. For me, it's a gradation. Is it your hair is on fire problem, or is it a problem that that we can manage right at this time before a new jail is built? I think there's a great disagreement over just how big the problem is.
And we have raised guard pay, haven't we, in recent months?
Yes, but it's still puny.
It's still puny. And Diana, to her credit, she's the first professional correctional person to run the jail since 2006.
Okay. Some of the concern here that you hear legislators talking about extends to Frank White's chief of staff, a man named Caleb Clifford. How big of an issue is that, Sam?
Well, I think that nobody likes him.
Nobody in the legislature.
And
maybe someone out there in the world does.
His mom or someone.
His mom, I'm sure, likes him.
Yeah.
I don't think the legislature cares for him. I know that for what this is worth, former Sheriff Mike Sharp doesn't particularly care for him. Gene Peters Baker doesn't particularly care for him. He's abrasive, and he will admit that. What his ultimate goal is with Frank White and the county executive, I'm not sure. But I think that he is certainly a political problem within county government.
Again, we're talking about Jackson County government and County Executive Frank White, who's on the ballot this year. Voters are going to decide these proposed changes to the county charter, Mike, that deal with term limits and pay raises for legislators. Is this in any way connected to all this tumult surrounding Frank White?
Indeed it is. Greg Grounds, the legislator who's retiring, thought all this tumult was for him was a chance to take a look at county government and see what needed to be fixed. A lot of the differences, some of the proposals are to take authority away from the county executive and give it to the legislature or to the sheriff in the case of the jail.
Okay. And the state auditor, Sam Nicole Galloway, she is stepping in now to review county spending. Why is that happening?
Well, there is concern over whether the White administration has been completely transparent in the way that they've spent money. Many on the legislature have noted that they oftentimes put out a request for proposal or spending under $10,000, which is that threshold that you don't have to seek county approval. So there's some concern that there has not been total transparency. I just want to note that Auditor Galloway seems that she's going to be pretty busy in our area, not only with this, but it's looking like she's heading towards an audit of Clay County finances and the way they operate.
The legislature's, county legislature's auditor, Chrissy Wooderson, last year, I think it was last year, early this year, came up with a number of instances in which the White administration had gone around the legislature and got many of these under $10,000 purchases. They would break a $30,000 purchase up into three pieces, for instance, so they wouldn't have to go through it. The legislature is ultimately, or initially, wanted the state auditor to come in, but that they don't have the authority, and so Frank, who also wanted them to come in, ultimately asked for Galloway to take a look.
Let's turn in the few minutes we have left here to the issue of Frank White's personal finances that he didn't want to talk about on the show. They've been very much in the news, and they are the reason, again, Frank isn't here today. The Missouri Attorney General is investigating Frank White. Why is that, Mike?
Well, the Star broke a story in December just before Christmas.
In fairness, you did, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Myself and Steve Ockrott. We broke a story that detailed a transaction in which someone helped Frank avoid a foreclosure sale of his home. According to our sources, a transaction involved a pass-through loan from a lawyer in Independence who does business with the county, funded this loan to Frank and his wife through another person so that they could avoid the appearance of a conflict of interest.
And the county charter says you can't take anything of value from someone who does business with the county, and that's an issue here too, right?
Yes, that's an issue. Initially, after our reporting, in which Frank declined to discuss his finances with us, Gene Peters Baker, the county prosecutor, initiated an investigation of this to take a look and see if there were any rules or laws violated. And then she handed that off to the Attorney General in June.
His home has nearly been foreclosed upon several times, right, Sam? That's sort of maybe at the root of this.
That's the reporting.
Yeah, three times at least. Yeah. How serious of an allegation do you see all this, Sam Zeff?
Well, I think that it's really more appropriate for state authorities to look at it. You know, he has supporters that suggest that this is no different than anybody else who might go through a rough patch in their own personal finances. Of course, most people are not the county executive of Jackson County.
Mm-hmm. And this might be why Frank sold a lot of his baseball memorabilia just recently, too.
There is certainly thought that he needed the cash to do that. You know, the person who did the auction for him would suggest that as star baseball players get older, lots of them sell off some memorabilia because that's just, you know, rings and gold gloves and bats and, you know, all the other stuff that you might gather in a stellar athletic career. How much of that stuff can you really have around the house? Mm-hmm. So there is the suggestion that this is what happens. A lot of baseball players do that. But clearly, Frank White could use the money.
You know, there's some, I guess, semi-breaking news this week, Mike Hendricks, when it comes to news about the Jackson County primary for sheriff. Involving several candidates, including the incumbent appointee, Daryl Forte, the former police chief of Kansas City, Missouri. Are we going to have a primary for sheriff that counts, or we're waiting for a court ruling? Where do we stand here?
Well, I checked CaseNet today, and there's nothing scheduled until November for a case management meeting on this case. I don't know if the judge is going to step in earlier or not. And I had a call into the head of the Democratic Committee this morning, but did not hear from him to find out what the latest is on that.
If by chance a judge rules that the primary should not go forward, what happens then?
Got no idea,
but
frankly.
The County Democratic Party
supposedly,
Central Committee would pick.
Supposedly. Well, here's what's interesting to me is the on the Democratic Party's website, they offered no discussion, no objections to the way Frank appointed Daryl Forte back in April or May, and then suddenly this comes up in early July. This lawsuit, I don't understand the motivation necessarily, and I don't know who they would pick if they were successful.
And Sam, just to be crystal clear here, the dispute, the disagreement here is that Daryl Forte was improperly appointed?
No, the dispute here is that what the Democratic Committee suggests is that state law says that the committee should be the person to pick the candidate as opposed to a primary election. So they're objecting to the primary, not the way that Forte was picked as interim sheriff. I do want to say that there are two Republicans running for sheriff in an election that has been covered with mishigas now for who knows how long. And so who knows what's going to happen in the Republican primary if the judge says agrees with the county Democratic committee. Would this affect the Republicans, the two Republicans running for Jackson County Sheriff, and that is completely unclear at this time.
So stay tuned to KCUR for potential breaking news when it comes to the primary for Jackson County Sheriff here. Well, I want to thank Mike Hendricks from The Star, Sam Zeff from KCUR for giving us a good rundown on all these issues involving Frank White, the Jackson County Executive. Thank you very much. Appreciate it, guys.
Pleasure, Mike.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the art world and is it too heavily dominated by white people? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Still not sure why President Trump entered into a trade war with China. Yesterday, we explored the legitimate concerns behind the tariffs. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow on the show, one candidate for Jackson County Executive who will be us in the studio, that's Matthew Merriman. An interview with him tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Steven Nelson is about to join us as one of our guests today, and he belongs to an unusually exclusive club. As of a few years ago, he was one of six, and I mean count them, six, full professors in art history who are black in the United States. It's no surprise, then, that the leadership of art institutions is often made up mostly of white people. What are the implications, and why and how has that come to be the case? That's the topic for our second half today. With us, Stephen Nelson is director of the UCLA African Studies Center and a professor of African and African-American art there. Stephen, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Steve. Great to be here.
Sunny Joy Thompson Ruffin is back with us. She's a Kansas City resident and a contemporary fabric artist, fabric designer, author, lecturer, and independent curator. She's exhibited her textile art at the Smithsonian American Art Museum. Sunny, so good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Professor Nelson, is that number still six, just six black full professors of art history across the entire expanse of this country?
Fortunately, no. It's gone up. And if I had to guess, it might actually be up to about 13 or 14 or even 15.
That's a more than doubling. What's going on out there?
Well, part of it's generations and ranks and people coming up for promotions, a bunch of people coming up for promotions in short order and getting them. And so it's a good sign.
You know, the million-dollar question then, as far as our conversation is concerned, Professor, why is that? Why so few?
I think part of it, and I think it's a complicated question, and I think part of it is an issue of pipeline, where we have not, art history is not a hugely diverse field. And when you have, say, few numbers of people of color, you know, black or brown, entering the ranks, then, you know, diversity gets, you know, less and less and less as you go farther up the food chain.
Sonny, I'm not sure I'm quite understanding this. Why isn't art history more diverse? What's the issue there?
I think a lot of it has to do with economics a majority of the time.
Meaning?
Education is selective, of course, and art oftentimes is the first thing eliminated. In education, lower education, actually.
Yeah, like in elementary schools, middle schools,
high schools, things of that sort. And art is a part of American history. It's a part of history, actually, and should be incorporated during that time. And it isn't looked upon as that. So I think that has a lot to do with it as well.
So this notion that there are, what, a dozen full professors of art history across the entire country, I gather that you're not utterly, completely shocked by that.
No, not at all. I'm not surprised at all. There should be more, absolutely should be more, because the African-American canon is extremely important to the arts. However, again, it has a lot to do with education and economics, the economics of education.
You discouraged by it? As someone who toils in the art world full time here?
I'm not discouraged by it. It allows me an opportunity of conversation and encouragement, encouraging young people to look at the arts very seriously and to have conversations with educators as it pertains to the arts and history and how important it is, and they go hand in hand together. So it helps in that we can push a little more. We can encourage a little more, a lot more, actually, in looking in that direction as far as education is concerned.
Stephen Nelson, are you discouraged by it?
I'm not. Well, it depends on the day.
and the hour.
But I couldn't agree with Sunny Joy more. I think that that we have the economics of education. I think that there are opportunities for conversation. And for me, the opportunity exists in different places to start changing the structures of how we do things. So instead of just saying, oh, we need diversity, how can we partner that with increasing access? Mm-hmm. And I think that there are, you know, fissures here and there where those conversations and some real sort of changes might be possible. But I couldn't agree with Sunny Joy more, where, you know, part of the issue is that art, unlike STEM fields, you know, are not seen as sort of fundamental parts of curriculum. And so, you know, we can get to college or we can get to graduate school, and art or art history is just not on the menu. I mean, many schools, I mean, part of the low numbers is that a lot of places don't even teach art history.
Yeah. Steve, I want to go back to a word you used just a minute ago, access. You're talking about when you use that word access, you mean what?
I mean economic, you know, sort of diversifying, not just in terms of race, ethnicity, gender, but in terms of economic status. Because the issue we have around art and art history is that it's seen as the purview for people who have resources and means. And so, I mean, even for myself, you know, I entered art history because I was a budding artist and I was forced to take it. But I had no conception of what that was before I was about a junior in college. And so in terms of access, oftentimes by that point, it's too late. you know, it's I think it's necessary for, say, museums and institutions of higher learning and, you know, secondary institutions to start, you know, exposing people to art in meaningful ways. So, you know, in ways that aren't just the we're going to sort of draw at the museum on a Sunday afternoon.
Are we seeing some of that happening, Sunny, as you look across, you know, Kansas City, the Midwest? Is that kind of idea of access and indoctrinating kids of all colors and stripes into the arts, is that beginning to change? Or is it still in retreat?
I think it's a little of both, honestly. Speaking of the Midwest, if you will, we've lost a lot of that free programming, introductions, access to free programming as it pertains to the arts. Everything has a cost to it. So again, we go back into economics. So I'm seeing some, but not a lot. Yeah. Not what I'd really like to see happen. Children being exposed, buses being used to take children to the various museums and cultural institutions.
Right.
That does become the responsibility of either the parents or the schools or those organizations that are available. That, again, goes into economics.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about the dearth of people of color in the upper echelons of the art world in this country. Professor Nelson, the consequence of all this is what? What should our listeners be concerned about here when you see this, as I said, this dearth of African Americans in the upper echelons here? What does that translate to?
I think it translates to a situation where you know, the problem begets the problem. And so as one sees few people of color in upper echelons in the art world, it makes the art world appear as a closed entity. So we don't see ourselves, so we don't even try.
Is that ever articulated, that idea? Do young African American kids literally see it that way?
I think that, and this is not unique to the arts, I think that across the board, in whatever industry you want to look at, when people do not see themselves reflected, and this is true in popular culture as well, they think that it is not a place where they belong.
Sonny, you're not in
I'm
not
in my
head.
I'm in total agreement. That's just quite the truth of the matter. Because when you do not see yourself, why would you support something of that sort?
Exactly.
Why would you incorporate yourself insert yourself into something like that, and you don't see the support for yourself? You don't.
Exactly.
There's no visualization. There is no activity. There is nothing offered to you. So therefore, why would you want to be participatory with something like that?
Sunny, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but what you just said, does that apply to the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art?
At one time it did, yes.
At one time?
At one time it did. They're growing. Most of the museums are growing. And I will put the Nelson with the rest of the museums across the country. They're beginning to learn. And it's a process. It's definitely a process. And you have to be willing and capable of engaging into community, because then you're getting into community. There are no guidelines financially when it comes to that, because you're dealing with human beings.
Yeah.
So therefore, yes, they're learning and they're proactive within the community now. That has to do with leadership, has a lot to do with leadership and what they have chosen to respect and how they've chosen to do that.
Yeah.
I kudos to the Nelson, because they're one in a few, in a handful, quite frankly.
You know, if there are just a few people of color in terms of art history professors, you can only imagine the number of African Americans in top positions at museums across the nation. In 2015, the Andrew Mellon Foundation supported a survey to gauge ethnic and gender diversity across the country's museums. The results were eye-popping. Get this, 84% of the country's museum staff was white. Blacks made up 4%, Asian Americans 6%, Native Americans and Native Hawaiians 0. Women fared better at almost 60% of professional museum staff. Significant numbers of non-white staff tended to be in jobs like security, human resources, facilities, and finance. Again, Sunny, is that surprising, these numbers to you? Again, the number of African Americans coming in just 4% here?
Of course not.
Yeah.
Not
4%.
At all. I know.
Yeah.
I understand that. Understand something. At one time, African Americans were not allowed in museums, and that was not too long ago.
Mm-hmm.
Or there was a day.
And that
designated
legacy, we think of that as a long time ago, but your point is
no, yeah. Not at all. No,
not at all.
Not at all. And it isn't unusual. It's a practice. For those that understand what the separation practices have been in and outside of this country, oftentimes that is control. So therefore, these are things that's just a reality. So no, it's not surprising at all.
Mm-hmm.
It has got to change.
Yeah.
In order for there to be a future within, because this is a business. So in order for there to be a future, these things have to change. You have to recognize the contributions of the African American narrative, the African American aesthetic, what we have contributed not only to the arts but to the world itself within the arts and history. So therefore, it's not unusual, but it's definitely time for a change.
So Professor Nelson, so what is happening out there to change that 4% number? I know we've touched on it here, but what are you seeing?
I'm glad you brought up this study. And I think with African American potential students and professionals, and I think we need to talk about Latinx as well, there are a few places here and there who are trying to sort of start initiatives to increase the pipeline, to help, get more students of color.
How can they just be starting these efforts? I mean, science has been diversifying for years. You know, these numbers are so dramatic. Why aren't we seeing, sort of a panicked-induced rush here to change numbers like this?
This is, you've asked the $64,000 question.
Okay.
And
I don't get paid that much money, though, Professor.
Right? And the sciences have long been ahead of the humanities in terms of initiatives towards diversifying the ranks and, attracting more undergraduate and graduate students of color. And I actually think that art history and the humanities more generally could take a few pages out of the playbooks of science programs, of STEM programs, and start reaching out to high school, start reaching out to a broader swatch of colleges, and trying to ferment interest in these kinds of fields, and seeing these fields as potential for a rich career, because we're also up against the myth that if you go and get an art degree or an art history degree, correct, you are going to be poor.
Mm, correct. Mm-hmm. Correct.
And
Sunny, I'm repeating myself here, but it is astonishing to me that with numbers like that from several years ago, that we're not seeing more of a push here, because in this changing world, when you have numbers like that, that's going to work against you pretty quickly.
Well, that's very true, of course. Yeah. However, you have to, and I agree with Professor Nelson, understanding where the sciences have gone, but also the sports as well as music. They were ahead of their time when it came to the integration process.
Right.
So black and brown people have had to look at where are their dollars going to be more effective.
Mm-hmm.
And the arts have not always been at the top of that list.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the truth of the matter. When you're told that you're not going to be able to make a living as an artist, Well, there are other alternatives as well,
yeah,
right, that you have to look at educationally that will drive you towards the arts, whether it is teaching or architecture or something of that sort. Something that's going to be viable and an offering, a positive offering within the community. So you have to pick and choose, actually.
Right. Professor Nelson, how long have you been aware of this problem?
Oh, since I was a graduate student.
Okay.
And so, I mean, I entered graduate school. I mean, I was in my late 20s. And so in the early 90s, I entered graduate school. And I was the only black student in my department. And there, you know, we got to two. Or even my own graduate students. I've been teaching graduate students now for a couple of decades, and I've had very few African-American students. Out of all of them, I've had four. And one left the field, and the other three are doing fine. But I think that one thing I would like to mention is that actually the Mellon Foundation has been working with five different museums across the country at diversifying the ranks in part in tandem with that report. And they've brought in, I believe it's about 30 students at different places and you know, trying to sort of get them interested in curatorial work, development, education, and the like. And it has had some positive effects. I mean, so we have seen a couple of my own students, undergraduate students, have then gone on to graduate school.
But it sounds like what you're saying here today, Professor, is that patience is going to be required given the history, given the barriers that have formed over the decades when it comes to people of color feeling welcome in museums like the Nelson Atkins and others.
Oh, I think that we should just burn down the house. I think that patience, we've had way too much patience. That's the problem. And we don't see these problems as structural, and that's huge. And so, you know, it's not just, you know, administrators don't just have to be open. They have to be open to changing the ways that they do business. And that's the bigger issue. And I don't think that this is unique to the arts.
And you mean what by that, Stephen?
That we have our definitions of what, you know, what constitutes excellence or what constitutes a viable candidate. Or, you know, in whatever, you know, either at the university or at the museum or in a gallery. And we might have to change some of those assumptions.
Right.
If we're really, if diversity is a core value and something that's not seen as additive.
We're talking about the need for more diversity in the upper ranks of art institutions across the nation. Our phone number, 816-235-2888. How big of a problem is this? That's the question on the table, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Kevin from Kansas City, Missouri. Kevin, good morning.
Hi there. Good morning. Another great show and great topic. And amidst all these, frankly, gloomy facts, is the fact that in the last couple of years, I've noticed that at Plaza Art Show, Art Fair, and in Westport and Brookside and others, some young artists, yes, of color, whatever you want to call them, are showing their work, and it is brilliant and unique and beautiful and fun, and it's heartening to see. It gives a person hope.
That's interesting. Sonny, what about big arts gatherings like the Plaza Art Show? Everyone knows about that, the Brookside Art Fair. Are those events doing enough to encourage people of color to take part?
No, they're not. And they need to do more. Because when you look at the amount of artists that apply, what happens to be the requirement? What is expected? How many pieces? You have to create an inordinate amount of work in order to participate in an art fair or an art festival. So what are those requirements and who is making those decisions? So you go back to the board, you go back to economics again, because that does play a major role in things of that sort. So the Plaza Art Fair, Brookside, Westport, the Unplaza, I can name them all. When you look at that amount, where is that taking you? And how serious does that artist want to be taken? Again, you have to take a very good look at those standards that are in front of you.
Do you see the same issue out in the Los Angeles area, Stephen?
I think it's pretty similar. And we have, you know, currently the Los Angeles Municipal Galleries has its large juried show, and it just opened a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, in terms of diversity, it actually is quite good. And in part, that's because the Municipal Gallery mm-hmm. did its due diligence
right.
in coming up with a diverse jury.
You know, I'm wondering how the two of you yeah. reacted to the furor earlier this year over the Brooklyn Museum's appointment of a white woman to oversee the museum's yeah. African mm-hmm. art collection. Mm-hmm. Sonny, were you surprised, infuriated? This is, you know, New York City. What did you make of it?
I wasn't surprised at all.
Mm-hmm. Given what we're talking about here.
Yeah, exactly. I wasn't surprised at all. That is a general practice.
Mm-hmm.
You have to understand, however, African-American art and African art, two very different practices.
Yes.
However, you also have to understand who's making those choices, because you're dealing with a board of people. You're dealing with jurors that mm-hmm. are making a decision. And what is it that they really want? What are they really looking for?
Right.
Because it was discouraging that the decision was made to do something of that sort. And this is the Brooklyn Museum, who attests to having a very long relationship in exhibiting and the offerings within the African-American canon.
Stephen, there was an uprising against that appointment. The Brooklyn Museum fought back and said, no, we're standing by their pick. How did that resolve itself?
And you know what? In full disclosure, I know the person they hired.
Mm.
And in full disclosure, I support what Brooklyn did.
Ah,
and,
okay.
And so because, you know, coming back to this issue of African-American versus African art history is by and large populated by white women. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not about excluding people of color. I would kill myself to get a person of color as an Africanist.
Yeah.
And if you want to talk about those numbers, I'm one of very few Africanists of color in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and we also should note that Brooklyn job is a 2-year job. It is a part-time job.
Okay.
And so, you know,
okay.
It's, yeah, it was not a surprise.
We're going to leave our good conversation there. Stephen Nelson, thanks so much. Director of the UCLA African Studies Center. Appreciate your time, Stephen.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sonny Joy Thompson-Ruffin, a fabric designer. Her work has been at the Smithsonian American Art Museum. Always good to have you, Sonny. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on the show, candidate for Jackson County Executive, that'll be Matthew Merriman. He'll be with us. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. Yesterday on the show, I spoke with the chair of the Kansas GOP. You can hear his thoughts on the upcoming primary election and his party's chances for expanding influence in Topeka. Go to kcur.org/up-to-date. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.